This is the third of our series on the open mind concerning the impact of television on American life. And today we deal with a very practical subject, practical because we're at election time. The question of TV and politics probably, well, resolves itself into maybe into two questions. One, can TV spots and commercials and political speeches, I'm referring, of course, to all politically oriented spots and commercials, push or pull or cajole a candidate to victory at the polls? Secondly, can TV create a climate of opinion in which possibly one and only one candidate or one and only one party can win in November? These are the questions that we want to consider today, and I think it's probably interesting that the Television Bureau of Advertising has put out this pamphlet, Win with Television. And, of course, the implication, at least for the industry, is that television can mold opinion, at least in the area of politics. Now let me introduce my guests. Joining me today to discuss TV and politics first is Professor Eric Goldman, professor of history at Princeton University, author of Rendezvous with Destiny, and consultant on the mass media to the Fund for the Republic. My second guest is Mr. John L. Elliott, Jr., vice president and director of BBD&O and prominent in Republican campaigns. My third guest is Mr. Lloyd Whitebrook, executive vice president of Castor, Hilton, Chesley & Clifford, is currently handling Democratic campaigns. Now, you gentlemen, addressing myself to the gentleman from Madison Avenue, have been very much involved in this question of TV and politics. Suppose for a minute I leave you and ask Professor Goldman to comment upon a quotation from an article that Senator Richard L. Neuberger, Democrat of Oregon, had in Esquire magazine. This was an article that he wrote on Madison Avenue and politics, but I think that we could probably narrow this quotation down to TV and politics. He says, "In fact, it is so significant that it may well revolutionize politicking in this country and could definitely turn out to be the most decisive single factor governing American politics during our generation." And I'd ask you to comment on that, Professor Goldman.
It seems to me that Mr. Neuberger's remarks are essentially true, but a bit extreme. I would suggest that historically, many of the techniques, many of the methods of exploitation which television uses have been a part of the democratic process for a long time. On the other hand, it does seem to me to have introduced a number of new things, some of which are good and some of which are bad. The obvious good, that in many, many cases, television has brought a new vitality to the whole electoral process. The parts of it that disturb me, I would suggest three things, I think. One of them is that it's made the role of money even more important in campaigns. Television is so expensive, whoever has the most money has the most advantage. The second would be, and here with all due respect to the distinguished practitioners of the art to my right, it seems to me, given too much control over the making of issues to men who are not entirely competent to make them, namely the advertising agencies. And the third part of it that disturbs me is the tendency of television to raise to an even greater extent the degree to which the irrational plays a role in the democratic process. Those are the things that bother me.
Well, gentlemen, Mr. Elliott?
Well, I certainly disagree with the first two, and I think I disagree with the third point, but if I go into all three points, it may be the half hour may be up. So let me just start on the first one, the question of money. Now, it's true that television costs a lot of money, but the fact of the matter is that there are individual companies in this country that spend $20, $30 million a year advertising soap or other products. What actually is spent in television campaigns? Well, nationally, the Republicans have outspent the Democrats at a ratio of about 5-4, or 4-3, depends on how you figure the figures, but it's about 5-4. But the fact of the matter is that the Republicans only spent $2.2 million nationally on television in 1956. Well, now, if you're going to spend $20 million advertising a product a year, it certainly seems to me a modest expenditure to spend $2.2 million advertising a political philosophy and a way of life every 4 years. And I think that we take a very naive approach to the amounts of money that are spent. Every campaign, at the end of every campaign, there are investigations about all the money that was spent, but compared to the spending by our companies, it's infinitesimal. And if I may just comment on, I don't want to monopolize this, but if I could just comment on the second point that Professor Goldman made, which is the control over issues, I honestly think that there is a great misconception as to just what the role of advertising agencies in political campaigns is. We've, at BBDO, been involved with a great many. And as a matter of fact, you might be interested to know that the first one we were involved in was before Barton, Durston, and Osborne even came into existence. The George Batten Company had the job of the Charles Evans Hughes campaign in 1916. And an interesting little thing about that is that they came to discussing where the money should be spent, and they came around to discussing California, and apparently nobody in the George Batten Company had ever been to California, and nobody in the Republican committee had ever been to California, so they decided not to spend any money in California, and that's just one of the little sidelights on what happened in California.
The caliber of advice has risen.
The caliber of advice has gone way up since then.
Let me take this question of influence. Professor Goldman raises it, I think, as a very serious question. I ask Mr. Whitebrook, what do you think that the Madison Avenue advisors, consultants, account executives do play a large role in determining the
campaign? Nowhere near the role. It appears that a great many of the academicians, philosophers, and advisors to the candidates play. Actually, you'll find the Madison Avenue, or so-called Madison Avenue advertising agency approach, is simply the technical approach of advising exactly how the medium of television should be used, how the medium of newspapers should be used, how the medium of radio or outdoor or literature, much more so than the business of writing issues. Well, but the basic thinking that goes behind that, let me carry this one step further, Professor. The basic thinking is the same kind of thinking that would be used in any intelligent approach, and the approach to the use of advertising agencies by political parties is the same as their approach to the use of lawyers, scientists, and other professional people. When you go into a campaign, you naturally approach it from the point of view of what are the important issues. After you've researched the issues, the next question becomes one of how to use these issues in the best possible manner, how to present them. But on the subject of money, which I'd like to just address myself to for a point, because we Democrats are always pleading poor and usually on the right side of pleading poor. I don't know where the 5-4 or 4-3 figure comes from, but I would say this, Mr. Elliott. When you spend $2,200,000 in 1 month, it's a far cry from spending $20 million in a year. The concentrated effort of that amount of money does have a tremendous impact.
Well, look, it's the impact that we're concerned with here. I think that this question, are you gentlemen saying that whether you play an important role behind the scenes or an unimportant role, are you saying that television can push your candidate if you spend $2.2 million in 1 month?
No question about it. Television has another advantage, and one that's very important, and it's a very positive one on the electorate. And you, I think, mentioned this before, Mr. Elliott. The fact of the matter is that television has taken the candidate off the soapbox where the very people who look at him are his partisans, naturally, because they're the ones that will go to a meeting, and brought him into the living room, exposed him to people who wouldn't necessarily see him, who wouldn't necessarily hear the issues, who wouldn't necessarily be exposed to politicking. And it's brought this candidate into the home, exposed public opinion, the possibilities of a candidate's evil or good intentions being brought to the people in their home, not with their own choice necessarily, but because they happened to flip a dial or because it happened to follow a very popular program that they were listening to. So that the electorate is better informed, and a candidate who can communicate well, just as any political figure has to communicate these days, will naturally benefit.
Well, there's a wide area of agreement, obviously, between us, but there's some very direct disagreement, and I'd like to point out the disagreement. On the money point, I don't understand Mr. Elliott's argument. It seems to me irrelevant how much is spent on business operations. What is important is, if we all agree that television has an impact, then whoever has more television has a greater impact. This means, since television is an important and expensive item, that the party which spends the most money gets the greatest impact. Now, as I understand it from some reading, and you gentlemen know more about this than I do, the saturation campaign of the Republicans an extremely expensive operation, was something which the Democrats had also thought of. The Democrats could not use the saturation campaign, which was very effective, because they didn't have the money. This gave a tremendous advantage to the other side. But I'm really more interested in this second point. It seems to me that if you read a study, like, for example, the Stanley Kelly book on politics and public relations, you find instance after instance in there, quotation after quotation, where the advertising man, the public relations man, says that he must control appropriations, he must control to a great extent personnel, and he wants a large share in determining issues, or he cannot be successful. And the most famous, or shall I say most notorious, instances of that, the Whitaker operations, at Whitaker-Baxter operations in California, where the Whitaker-Baxter team won 70 out of 75 campaigns, are instances where the firm itself says it makes all issues. Well, and it made them with people like Warren, it made them with people like Goody Knight. Now, I would want to add just one more thing here, if I may. It's not simply a question of making the issues, it's a question of the avoidance of issues. I remember the famous saturation campaign in which the Eisenhower candidacy was presented in terms, my favorite, was the cab driver, the alleged cab driver, going by the White House, and he sees the little light flickering there, and he says, "I need him." This is an avoidance of issues. Those are the things that bother me.
Well, Mr. Elliott?
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Elliott. I'm going to take one thing. I agree with you that the word notorious is a much better adjective to describe certain types of activities in this field. I think anybody in this field who brags about how important they are, A, is wrong, and B, is taking credit after the ballots have been counted on Election Day.
Of course, you're bragging about the impact of television.
That's one thing, but bragging about the fact that you are the one who decides the issues, that makes the point and tells the candidate what to do and makes him dance like a puppet at the end of a stick is sheer hogwash.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can imagine how candidates like Stevenson or Eisenhower would welcome an advertising man coming in and telling him how to dance the dance. That'd just be ridiculous.
Yet you have yourself told the story of how at a meeting at Morningside Heights, the advertising men indicated to General Eisenhower what the best procedure would be from your point of view as far as conducting a campaign from a certain point in the preliminaries on, and you succeeded in putting that across.
Well, that's true. What we pointed out in that meeting, that was in 1952,
mm-hmm.
and we just happened to be the spokesman for the people who were making the point, and that was that there were 3 weeks in the 1952 campaign when President Eisenhower didn't appear on television, and in those 3 weeks, Governor Stevenson was appearing on television, and as a result, we pointed out at that meeting, for example, that it would take 3 years of back platform speeches from trains to reach as many people as one telecast could reach in one night. But I think that we can overemphasize this influence of television and the influence of money, getting back to the money aspect, because after all, in any political campaign, I think that, and I think that statistics would bear this out, that 75 to 80% of the people have made up their mind how they're going to vote before the campaign even starts. And how you're going to vote is a matter that's a composite of your heritage and your environment and your welfare at the present time, and also your intelligent evaluation over the past 4 years of what the party in power has been accomplishing and trying to accomplish. So that to put too much emphasis on what happens in 1 month before election time, I think, is wrong.
Well, how would you evaluate, let's say, the spot campaign, the Eisenhower spot campaign, in the last month of the 52 campaign?
Well, if you were to ask me purely personally, mm-hmm. the way I personally evaluate it, I was never too enthusiastic about it. I frankly felt there were some phony aspects to it.
In terms of its impact.
I felt that you couldn't tell the story that you wanted to tell in 20-second spots.
Do you think it made votes, though?
Well, of course, in that campaign, Eisenhower could have gone to the Hawaiian Islands for the month and come back and been elected. It's impossible to say.
It is impossible to say what actually won. But to address myself to the point that you made, taking the impact of television as being terribly important on a campaign, and I do think that television is probably the single most important medium and the single most important effect in any campaign, the money aspect does become important. And the amount of voters who have made up their minds prior to the election day approach, I think, is far less as a result of this tremendous impact. We're continuing studies on opinion research, not so much how people are going to vote, but what the issues are and how important the issues are, because people don't actually tell you how they're going to vote. They tell you what they think they'd like you to hear or what they'd like you to believe about them. And we have found that the amount of undecided vote since 1952 has grown to the point where today, in a great many states, better than 30% of the electorate is honestly undecided, and that's a sufficiently large enough percentage, even with a 60-40 among the balance of the vote, to make you feel that television is important. The amount of money is terribly important. We do find it difficult to buy time without money. The networks and the individual stations insist on cash in advance, for one thing. There's no credit policy allowed, and it's a good policy, too, on the part of the stations. But if, for instance, the Congress were to allow, say, a maximum of a $500 deduction for income tax purposes for a political contribution, a great deal more money would be available to political parties, and the charge that big business subsidizes the Republican Party and labor to some extent subsidizes the Democratic Party would go out the window, and I think that would be an important thing, too.
Well, whether that happens or not, let me ask you this question, and ask both of you gentlemen this. Do you think you can merchandise a candidate? Given the notion that you don't pick the candidate, you don't even pick the issue.
Well, you can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. If somebody's a sow's ear, he's going to look like a sow's ear on television. He's going to be like that no matter what you do.
But that doesn't answer the question, really. Let's assume we're not dealing with sow's ear.
Can you merchandise a candidate? No. I don't think you can merchandise something that is not there. You have a man of ability and a man of integrity. If he is able to communicate, you can teach him how to speak better. You can teach him how to present himself more effectively. But you can't make him into something that he isn't. Don't forget, demagogues were here before television. We had Huey Long a long time before television. We had Abraham Lincoln a long time before television. And Abraham Lincoln would be damn fine on television today.
Well, Roosevelt was pretty good on television,
right,
too.
Joe McCarthy, yeah, the greatest demagogue of all time, was actually exposed by television.
How do you feel about this, Professor Goldman?
Well, let's go back for a moment to this issues question. It seems to me that the essence of public relations and advertising from the beginning has been the demand that if it's to be effective, it must determine to some extent policy as well as techniques. This, as I understand, is the history of all advertising and public relations.
Well, where do you understand that from, Professor Goldman?
From Ivy Lee on.
Well, I've never heard it put quite that way. I know about Mr. Elliott.
Well, one can find infinite statements of it, I would say, in the whole literature of that.
Put it this way, if I can just interrupt. If somebody goes in to buy a blanket into a store, the salesmen in the store want to find out what the person wants from a blanket. They may want a washable blanket, or they may want a blanket that's warm, or they may want a blanket that's soft, or they may want a blanket that's lightweight. So it doesn't make any difference that he has blankets that are all four of those things. If he wants to sell a blanket, he wants to find out what the person wants in a blanket, and then he points out that that's what's wanted. Now, one of the things that happens in political campaigns is that research is done to find out what issues the public is interested in. And after that, those are the issues that are stressed predominantly in the campaign. It doesn't mean that the candidate doesn't have specific ideas and stands on other issues, but he knows that the public is more interested in these issues, so he tells how he feels about those issues.
But your very analogy would mean that what the advertising technique does is to say that the candidate will stress what a largely ill-informed public thinks should be stressed. And the principle of democratic leadership is leadership, that the candidates are supposed to bring to the fore the issues which they consider important. And this is a kind of Gallup poll democracy, which is running things downhill gradually in this country. Let me go a little further, though, if I may, on this. Unless the whole literature of this subject is incorrect, the steady drive, I would argue, of all public relations and advertising men, and it's sensible from their point of view, has been to have a larger role in the determination of issues and policy. Because obviously they can be most effective that way. And if you take this famous team, which I understand why you men disparage them, but they are a famous team, they have been very effective, when a reporter asked them, could you have won 70 out of 75 of those elections if you had the other side, if you had the other candidate, they said yes.
Well, that's not so. As a matter of fact, they had an issue in California, as a matter of fact, not so long ago, on the oil, the offshore oil issue, and they lost out on it, and they took the side that had the most money, and they took the side that didn't have the basic issue on its side. The opposition group won out. But what you're talking about,
I just want to add one thing to it, Mr. Heffner, if I may.
The Tippecanoe and Tyler, too, and Rum, Romanism, and Rebellion, and other famous slogans came out long before advertising agencies were ever dreamed of.
Yes, but now you're...
And they cater to what you're talking about, the Gallup poll type of political
That's why I think,
thinking.
Professor Goldman, that in a sense this is a little besides the point, because this is talking about Madison Avenue alone, or advertising techniques, or public relations techniques, which go back quite far.
Let's talk about television itself.
And talk about the question of, for instance, in my own researches on this, I came across a number of people who say that television, by the fact that it accentuates the accepted in our society, makes it less and less possible for a new person or a new idea, let's say in politics, to come to the fore. And then I come to a volume on this question itself, the Janowitz and Marvick book, and they say the availability of television for the first time in the 1952 presidential campaign was especially significant for the Democratic Party. It helped widen the arena of competition and offered a likelihood of offsetting the advantage Republicans have traditionally enjoyed in the editorial outlook of the American press. That television, however much money you may have to have for it, does project a personality that may be comparatively unknown into the homes that you were talking about.
No question about that. Governor Minor in New Jersey, who was unknown completely in 1953, used television probably as effectively and as adroitly as anybody has ever used it, and he was one of the first to actually project into a living room rather than to take a speech and deliver that speech from a public park where only partisans attend.
Doesn't this help the democratic process, Professor Goldman?
That is my point.
I think it differs in two ways. One is on the relevance of this question of general advertising and public relations to what we are talking about. It seems to me it's television which has made that important. When you said Tippecanoe and Tyler, too, it took 2 weeks, if that were said in Buffalo, for people to hear it in Chicago. And they did not hear it even then with the impact which television has. Now, on this other question, which has been raised here, has it helped the Democratic Party?
It seems to me, process.
Well, it was both.
Yes, but I'm asking whether in this general way it doesn't help the Democratic process by letting a man who's comparatively unknown very quickly. It doesn't take 2 weeks for Tippecanoe and Tyler to go from Buffalo to Chicago, but rather one night for a new man.
I should say it helps the Democratic process if it's used wisely, legitimately, and it hurts it if it's used in many of the ways it is used. For example, the projection of a candidate. Are we going to project this candidate as Mr. X, who stands for so-and-so, real issues, or are we going to project him as what Leonard Hall said we should project candidates as, a piece of merchandise? Are we going to, for example, emphasize a grin, which was one of the directives that went out to television people in one of the campaigns? So I don't think you can answer that question. It all depends upon the way the media...
I think you can answer it very easily. What I'd say, to be facetious, would be that the Democrats always do it the right way, you see.
I think the Democrats very often do it the right way. I think that the Republicans very often drag their heels in the correct use of television. For example, I think that the master of mass communications was Roosevelt. And he used fireside chats. He recognized a whole lot of basic principles. He recognized that he needed help to put across his ideas because there were masters in doing it. So he turned to Sam Rosenman and McLeish and Sherwood and so on. He got help from them.
And they talked about ideas and issues.
Sure, but that's fine. But they also recognized another basic concept, and that is the concept of continuity. And they were on all the time with these ideas. Now, I think that television does involve a tremendous sense of responsibility. I think that a president can get on and with effective use of television could entrench himself unbelievably well.
Well, when we were talking about
business of communication from a candidate, that's true. And there's one point. You talk about the sense of responsibility. I feel very strongly about that, Mr. Elliott. There's no FTC, no Federal Trade Commission in political advertising. If a product is falsely advertised, as you all know, the Federal Trade Commission will seek an injunction against the advertiser and have that advertising changed and penalize the advertiser. The only person who's penalized for buying a candidate who is not what he represents himself for is the voter. And he's got 4 years to wait to throw out this candidate. And so it imposes a tremendous sense of responsibility on the advertising fraternity to make darn sure that something isn't done that isn't correct, for which the FTC does not have a call. And that's why some of the practitioners do, in the course of their work, say things and do things that perhaps are not exactly right. And we have to watch that. We have to police our own
business.
Doesn't
this raise this question that Mr. Goldman was just raising? Mm-hmm. He said President Roosevelt and Rosamond would discuss ideas. Mm-hmm. And I remember the other week when we were talking about TV and learning, someone emphasized the visual role, the role of the visual. Doesn't TV emphasize just the opposite of ideas? And doesn't it make us, by definition, put us in the position of not of avoiding ideas, but using other things than ideas?
A picture is worth 10,000 words, the Chinese say.
Mr. Whitebrook, you smile when you say that.
No, I think this is a very important thing.
No, I know. I don't mean that you deny it by smiling, but you seem to feel that we've hit something very important here.
Yes, I think that the television medium takes it into the realm of vision, where the radio medium, about which you were talking about with Franklin Roosevelt's fireside chats, only attack one sense, that
of
hearing.
Doesn't this mean, then, that television emphasizes the non-ideological?
No, not necessarily at all. No, I think that it gives you an opportunity to sell that even more, to get across that idea better, because instead of just listening to it, you also have the opportunity of seeing what the idea is. Television is not merely a speech. Television can be a series of documentaries on politics. When a man talks about education, you can show better schools. You can also show how poor those schools were before this candidate came in or before an appropriation was legislated to get better schools.
We could all agree in a moment, I think, that television could be the most edifying and ennobling thing that ever happened to the democratic process. It seems to me the question before us is, as a matter of fact, how has it been used in politics? And here it seems to me you get to the question that an advertising man is a man who, as he should, thinks of his trade as one of merchandising a product. And when you apply advertising to politics, you get the merchandising techniques. And as we all agree, television makes them extraordinarily effective. Now, merchandising techniques, the selling of pots and pans, are traditionally, historically, done not through the rational, but through the irrational. Not through the ideological, but through appeals to a whole series of things which may be irrelevant to the main question as to whether the wife needs a pot or not.
We have no pictures, but gentlemen, the time is up.
Oh, sorry.
Thanks so much, Mr. Goldman, Mr. Elliott, Mr. Whitebrook.